Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Casterbus podcast with a K. With me this week is Brian Terranova.
Hello.
And James McLean.
Hello.
My name is Christian Corley, and I'm the editor of Casterbus and your host on the podcast. Wibbly, 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 wibbly. This week's podcast, we're going to be talking about John Nathan Turner, the man with the unfeasible name and the unfeasible Hawaiian shirts. And a big beard. He took over the role of producer of Doctor Who in, for the 1980s season with some wonderful stories such as Megalos and the Leisure Hive. Maybe we'll forget about Megalos. And the Leisure Hive and the whole East Space trilogy. And, you know, it was kind of a clearing out of the old guard and a bringing in with the new, and it culminating with the departure of Tom Baker and the introduction of Peter Davison as the Fifth Doctor. And he remained in the role until 1989, when Doctor Who was put on ice for a long time in a very deep freezer. He's one of those characters, isn't he, that's he's a very divisive character who's made lots of interesting decisions in his time in Doctor Who. So we're going to go through today's podcast with a few little questions that are going to sort of like prompt, you know, how we normally do. But they're all going to be focused on John Nathan Turner. So the first thing is, was John Nathan Turner good or bad for Doctor Who? James?
I thought he was brilliant for Doctor Who. I think the show was going down a very bad path by Graham Williams. I mean, there was a couple of quite good stories thanks to Douglas Adams, but by and large, the feel of it, the tone of it, the power that Tom had himself, it was not in a good place. And you can say that because every season progressively up to that point was getting more and more up to that point, to that sort of slightly farcical, whimsical, silly show that it was becoming. And I think John Nathan Turner's really kicked it into a different position, especially because, obviously, as they've all said on the production team, the issue of Star Wars at the time and how that was going to impact on the show. And I think John Nathan Turner's team really did revitalize the look of it. It didn't look quite as shoddy. It had a tone which was not trying to compete with Star Wars, and I thought that was a very clever approach. Mm-hmm. You take that first season that he did, it doesn't at all feel like Star Wars. It's just quite somber. It's quite, the pacing's quite slow. It feels comfortable with itself. So, yeah, I think he was very good. I think maybe his biggest mistake was is that he couldn't find an avenue to take the show as television changed in the mid-80s. And I think that was his biggest problem. And he was still working on the celebrity culture of the almost... of the variety performance, almost, you know, where you, I suppose we still do it now in today's Doctor Who, but it was all guest stars, and see, the guest stars would get the splash in the papers and they'll get people's attention. And way he was a very good PR man, not quite sure whether he sort of lost the identity of Doctor Who by sort of Colin Baker, or maybe the fact that Michael Grade came in and sort of said that Doctor Who's too violent and nasty, and that was the direction he was taking into something a little more adult, meant that they didn't know where to go with it by McCoy. And by McCoy, while I've said before, I love the stuff that was going on there, it did feel like the show's direction wasn't sure whether it should be a child show or an adult show. And that was something which I think you've got to put down to him really as being a problem.
Okay, Brian, John Nathan Turner.
I think I can agree in some ways he was definitely good for the show, and I think in other ways he was bad for the show. I do agree with what James said that, you know, the show toward the end of Tom Baker's era had become a little bit Tom Baker says all, you know, what he says goes. And I've always been more of a fan of Tom Baker's beginning than the end of his era. However, John Nathan Turner's last season, there were a lot of good things to really like in that one for Tom Baker. But at the same time, for the way I understand it, the show kind of came under cancellation threats quite a few times, and it was John Nathan Turner who had saved it in some way or another. But then again, at the same time, he made a lot of choices and a lot of decisions, which I kind of think helped spell the downfall for the show as well toward the very end. So in many ways, he did a lot of great things, and I really do like his era. I love, you know, Sylvester McCoy's era, Peter Davison's era, Tom Baker's last season, Colin Baker, as much as I love the man and the actor, I think his era is where it suffered a lot. Actually, certainly in Sylvester McCoy's beginning of his era as well. I think John kind of came back into his footing toward the end of Sylvester McCoy, and by then the damage was done from what he did starting in Colin's era. And there was no going back. But, you know, if the BBC had just reevaluated, I think the show could have continued on and really, like, grew again from Sylvester's last season.
But how much of that was Nathan Turner and how much of it was Cartmell and McCoy? I mean, that's a problem, isn't it? We don't know within the production team.
Well, there was a feature in DWM recently, which I'm, and dear listener, we've been planning to do this for months, but we've only just got round to it, just with all the stuff coming in. But the latest couple of issues of DWM have had a similar discussion, and they kind of generally agreed that John Nathan Turner was very good at picking the right people. To do, as writers and, you know, other production team staff. And I would say, well, he probably would take credit for a lot of what happened towards the end in terms of the themes of the stories and the darkness of the show. I think a lot of it did come from Cartmell. And I know Sylvester McCoy wasn't that happy with his first series either, so...
Because he doesn't feel, but then I mean, his stuff was quite the show was quite dark before they were castrated for their 18 months. So I mean, I suppose it'd be unfair to say that it suddenly became more mature, but it sort of became more mature in a different way.
Yeah,
I think Revelation of the Daleks was possibly the only one which carried some sort of kinship to where the show was going by 89. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
Possibly. Well, you could say the same about Cage of Androzani.
I was talking more about Baker's era, where it sort of was becoming quite a violent gruesome era compared to... Yeah, I totally agree. There were examples before that. So have you got another question? Because I feel this is very much a Christian question-led...
Well, no, what I was going to do was I was just going to come to myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was... As my two colleagues will know, I've been enjoying the old All Creatures Great and Small TV show on Netflix recently. And I'm just into the second series. Now, what strikes me about it is John Nathan Turner's production unit manager on... I haven't looked this up. I think he is for the entire series. And, you know, at the same time, he was doing Doctor Who. The odd episode of Doctor Who, or the odd serial of Doctor Who. But he's done production unit manager on this job for the entire first two series, at the very least. Now, what strikes me about that is he's clearly a very good organizer, because All Creatures Great and Small was filmed in a town in the Yorkshire Dales and in Birmingham for the studio parts. Now, up in the Yorkshire Dales, I mean, even now it's difficult to get out there and film. But we're talking about the 1970s, lugging great big cameras around, taking light in, sound people, actors out there on location, all that sort of thing. So he's clearly a very good organizer, which is what a producer needs to be. But the other thing about What Creatures Great and Small is the number of people in it that ended up being involved in Doctor Who, or who are already involved in Doctor Who, but that John Nathan Turner kept using. There's obviously Peter Davison, who we'll come to later. There's also Johnny Byrne, who wrote a few scripts later on for Doctor Who. There's Christopher Barry. There's at least one director from Doctor Who. Now, obviously, in the BBC in those days, there was a kind of a rota going around. So if you were a director, one week you might be working on Doctor Who, the next week you might be working on All Creatures Great and Small, the third week you might be doing, you know, like a one-off drama, etc. But the fact that these people keep recurring shows that he did know what he was doing. And, you know, you get these accusations about John Nathan Turner that he didn't know what he was doing and that he made a complete mess of Doctor Who, which clearly isn't true. He was doing the job for a long time, and he had good points and he had bad points. Like anyone doing a job for a long time would have good points and bad points, or good times and bad times. So I just wanted to just make the point that he was in the job for a long time, but he got the job for a very good reason, and that's because he knew the job inside out and he had the basic abilities, and, you know, that he'd been doing that job of organizing people for years.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that's something we do need to address, is the fact that he does get a horrendous amount of stick for so much in that show. I agree with you on those parts. I think there were some very strong things. What were the less strong things? Because I noticed that Brian pointed out when he was doing his point, he mentioned there were things that he felt he didn't do as well or didn't do right. I just wondered what Terra Nova specifically meant.
For me, I mean, a lot of it came down to, we talk about how Tom Baker kind of was in charge and put his foot down. And I understand that's technically what a producer is supposed to do, put their stamp on things and so on. But he didn't quite see what was best for the show. And a lot of things for me when it comes down to it was, you look at Peter Davison's era and you look at how crowded the TARDIS was and the atmosphere there. And I don't mind a crowded TARDIS because it worked in the first Doctor's era. It worked just fine. The problem was that John decided that, why don't we tell a story of people who don't want to be there? Well, if the characters don't want to be there, then the audience doesn't want to be there. You know, and you bring that to the next Doctor in line and you have him and his companion constantly at each other's throats and you have him just like being rude to everyone and crotchety, but not in an interesting way that the first Doctor was. And these were all choices that he had made to try and make the eras different. And I just feel that when he saw how it wasn't working in Peter Davison's era, and when he saw how well Peter Davison's era came at the end, when you got rid of all of that, it should have been a change for the next season, you know, for the next Doctor in line. And unfortunately, it just wasn't until you finally get to Sylvester's era. You know, they tried to mellow Colin out a little bit, but damage was done. It was too late. So those are the things that kind of get me. I just think that they could have been better. They could have been something. I guess my point is that, you know, yes, nothing is for everybody, but it seems like when you're driving away most of the audience, you're doing something wrong. And for me, certainly, those things drove me away. I don't watch Colin Baker's era nearly as much as I watch anybody else's. And when it comes to Peter Davison's era, I watch select few episodes. And they're both really good doctors, you know? I mean, forgetting the fact that he was the one who came up with Colin's outfit, which, of course, is a major minus to me. It was moments like that. Things that just, I felt, lost the spirit of Doctor Who and lost what the show was about.
Do you think he made a mistake then in that perhaps one thing you could put towards John Nathan Turner, he was, and we've said this before, he was very much about contrasts, and that was how he revitalized things. He didn't seem to feel very comfortable with a set idea for Doctor Who. He would just try and run to the next end of the spectrum. You know, Peter Davison was as far away removed as Tom Baker as possible.
Yeah, I think that's definitely what happened.
Colin Baker was the wrong, different way from Peter Davison, and as I still say, but I got to, and McCoy, I suppose, to a degree, how he was originally set out with no dignity, sort of woolly headed, sort of cheese hole, you know, couldn't really remember his phrases and everything, was very much different to Baker again. And maybe that's with the companions as well. And I don't know, perhaps that was an error.
I don't think it's an error so much in the respect that, you know, he definitely had it well thought out, you know, bring in somebody that wasn't like Tom Baker, which was a good idea, because you were not going to bring anybody in who was even remotely like Tom Baker that the audience would love, because all they were going to do was see them as a Tom Baker copy. And I get that. And I don't have an issue with Peter Davison. I do think that he had a rule that I didn't quite agree with, which was, Peter Davison was not allowed to hug or interact with his female companions in any kind of way that people might think was romantic because of their age gap being similar. I just thought that was a bit silly. But the concept was sound. The concept was good. I think he just went, certainly in the case of Colin Baker, he went too far in an extreme. You know, Colin had a plan, and I don't know if it was John Nathan Turner's plan with him, but, you know, he wanted to beat Tom Baker's record. He wanted to start out crotchety and mellow out and become this completely likable guy. Great plan, but after the first season of failure, it should have been immediately changed. It shouldn't have been let's try and fix this now, or rather, let's try and still continue with the plan, just slightly mellow him a little bit more. It was too much of a contrast. Peter Davison was a contrast that worked, and he worked well, and I know many people who count him among their favorite Doctor. You know, it's just reevaluating those ideas, I guess, is the thing that should have been done. Stuff that I think the damage in his era to me was unfortunately done in Colin Baker's era and the beginning of Sylvester McCoy's era. You know, there was that term while that I talked about in Peter Davison's, but his era is generally looked on pretty fondly from what I'm aware of. However, generally when I hear complaints, it is the fact that, you know, they do wish that Peter had companions who wanted to be with him.
Well, just out of fairness, how many, were we talking really just Adric and Tegan? And Adric only had a couple of moments of whininess in a whole sea of whininess, I know, but where he was actually upset about wanting to go back to E-Space. But
well, he wanted to go home in Earthshock, didn't he?
Yeah.
And also in Black Orchid, Visitation.
Oh, Visitation, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you also had Turlo. And Tegan kept constantly wanting to leave and then finally came back and then bickering and wanted to leave again. Like, Tegan was a constant source of back and forth, this is not good, like, whiny, whiny, whiny. Nissa was good, and I agree with Peter Davison. Nissa should have been, had some alone time as a companion with Peter Davison. She should have, she had the right makings of a good companion, and they unfortunately just never let them have that time together. Turlo, well, I think, I know a lot of people don't like him, but I thought he was an interesting character. I love the way he came on the TARDIS, and I love the situation that he was brought in with and how he had to kind of beat the odds type thing. Unfortunately, the way that they made him be coward and always wanting to run away from the danger rather than help his friends and so on was a big minus to me. You know, it's like you can bring somebody in and sure, maybe it's not the life that they want, but they can become the reluctant hero just as easily. Same, and it's pretty much the way the Doctor started out. You know, the Doctor started out in this show not wanting to get involved. He just wanted to explore what he wanted to explore and get the heck away from danger as quickly as possible, and then became the universe's greatest hero. They had that potential with Turlo. Not that I think he should have become the world's greatest hero, but he should have been affected by the Doctor in a better way. And they only did that really in the very end for the character. And that's, I think that's the thing. I think that's probably where a lot of it strikes for me as being wrong for an era. You know, even if you're not intentionally trying to do this, you should be looking at these characters and how they can grow. And I think John Nathan Turner kind of kept them locked in place because it suited the juxtaposed image that he was trying to create.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of juxtaposition throughout John Nathan Turner, isn't there?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, he did the wonderful thing of giving Tom Baker a new outfit. And, you know, it's striking, whether you like it or not. It's a very striking, the whole maroon look. There's the new there's the new theme tune arrangement and the new opening titles, which are, but I mean, I loved the new theme tune the first time I heard it back in 1980. I thought it was fantastic. And then you've got the question marks on the collars. Or you've got the casting of Ken Dodd. Or you've got the Trial of the Time Lord. Say that again.
I didn't say anything. I just had a little spasm. Bonnie Langford.
Oh, Bonnie Langford. Yeah, all right. So it's as if there's ideas that he's had that are like, they're brilliant, and then he sneaks in a crap one. Or that he gets on a roll with having great ideas, and then there's another idea that he has, and everyone's so chuffed with his other ideas, they think that, well, surely this one will be a great idea as well.
But that's maybe because, as I said before, a lot of his PR branding was sort of very BBC, which I suppose Doctor Who was, sort of Saturday night variety branding, where, you know, sort of your characters have an almost comic two-dimensionalness to them, like a lot of the presenters did to a lot of the shows. You know, they'd be known for single phrases, and so you have these question marks all over your main character because it brands him. And then you also have these variety like performers in like Bonnie Langford, who will get the news headlines and people know because she's often on Saturday nights as well. And so you get that sort of
well,
slightly
that's basically all she did, wasn't it? She was only there as press fodder. She didn't really, I mean, I like Bonnie Langford. So I like Bonnie Langford. She's good. But she's very good at what she does, and what she does isn't Doctor Who.
Well, you know what? Let me put it to you this way. You take these characters from John Nathan Turner's era, okay, and you see what John Nathan Turner and his people did with them. Then you take these same characters and you put them in Big Finish's era. Mind you, I know it's years later, and I know that their acting abilities can grow since then, and certainly storytelling has changed since then, but they are all likable and interesting characters, minus Adric, because I don't think Big Finish has really gone there, so I can't really, comment on him. But Bonnie Langford is good in the radio dramas. She's a good character. They give her things to do. And I think that's part of the problem, too, is that they didn't really give people like her character things to do. You know, Perry was brought in to basically whine, and then certainly with Colin Baker, bicker. You know, Tegan was brought in to whine and complain that she didn't want to be there. Adric, the one thing I always say, the one thing that whenever people talk about Adric, I say you have to remember, go back to Tom Baker's first, last season rather, John Nathan Turner's first season. Adric was actually a pretty good character. He started off, you know, a little kiddish, mildly annoying, but he had things to do and he was interesting. And then you get to Peter Davison's era and he just became that little brat that people didn't want there. Not even the TARDIS crew really wanted him until he died, and then they were sad that he was gone. You know, it was really a weird thing. Like, what happened? Why did they de-evolve the character like that? So that's something that says a lot to me. John Nathan Turner made a lot of good choices. He made a lot of bad choices. And sure, that can happen in anyone's era. But I think where a lot of his good choices were, if you look at things like we talked about, the visual element, where he wasn't trying to match Star Wars, he created his own. There was a feel in Tom Baker's last season, which I actually really enjoyed the feel of that last season. I mean, Tom's a little bit more somber than I would have liked, but I understand it. Whereas it seemed like he let the characters down more often than anything else.
Again, I think we need to go back to the people that he's employed as well. Christopher Bidmead was clearly a very good script editor, and he brought, I think, a lot of, I mean, beyond the opening titles, etc. What we see in Tom Baker's final series season is a completely new way of doing Doctor Who, which, and I know Bidmead would say that it's all real science that's in there. I don't think it's all real science in there. I think there is, he has got away from some of the sort of techno babble and some of the fantasy science, but there is still a little bit of fantasy science in there. But on the whole, it gives Doctor Who a completely new angle. You know, just the whole thing about the thermodynamics and entropy and all that business, and you've got regeneration, you've got Legopolis, you've got the stuff that's going on in the Leisure Hive, you've got Full Circle, and later on we've got the Eric Saward stuff, where it's not as tight, and it's basically Earthshock every episode. You know, he's going for that kind of all-out action thing, which is getting away from what we said at the beginning in that first series was ignoring Star Wars. Mm. But by mid-80s, with Revelation Daleks and Attack of the Cybermen, etc., it's trying to be Star Wars. It's trying to be Battlestar Galactica. It's trying to be a space opera, isn't it? Trying to be Buck Rogers, which is on the other side. And it does it reasonably successfully for Doctor Who, but at the same time it starts losing its identity somewhat. And at the same time you've got the whole mishmash of continuity going back to things that happened 20 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever, that most people couldn't remember anyway, so there's no need to mention them in the first place. They could have just reintroduced them as new characters, things like Omega or whatever.
But did that... I mean, I was going to say we should talk about that, because that is possibly, in my mind, it's actually quite a good season, and yet, by and large, if you hear the criticisms of John Nathan Turner's era... That season, because of its intentional retrospective, gets a lot of stick, doesn't it?
I think there's two ways of doing that whole retro continuity, that bringing old continuity in and updating it and recalling it and stuff. I think there's two ways of doing it. And the way that Russell T Davies and Stephen Moffat's show does it is the right way. The wrong way is what happened in season 20 with... that pointless explanations about stuff and no explanation about important stuff. And I know it wasn't entirely... I know everything didn't go as well as it could have done. Like the whole, you know, having the Brigadier in Mordred Undead instead of in Chesterton.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I know there's that aspect of stuff, but there is just this, and yeah, I'm not going to say it's purely Doctor Who, but there was only really Doctor Who that was recalling itself in such a way in 1983, 82, whatever. and after that. So I think that's one of the main reasons why people criticize this era, because of this narrow aspect of the era, because of the way that the whole exposition toward that relating the information about these old villains and things that happened 10 or 20 years ago on Doctor Who were dealt with. It was an info dump, or it was poorly contextualized, or just poorly acted. Even it has to be done in the right way, you know, like the Macra or even the Autons. You don't even need to really reference the fact that they've been in Doctor Who before.
But I mean, I would argue, as devil's advocate, I submit to you that the way that they were done in that era, I thought was actually quite well done. I didn't think that you really needed to know much about Omega to enjoy Ark of Infinity, although I will say there is a lot of pedestrianness to Ark of Infinity and a lot of pointless, something I do think John Nathan Turner did badly, and that's the going to a different country and then filming copious amounts of running around streets, which gets a little boring. But the actual idea, it wasn't like he just redid the Three Doctors. And again, with the other ones in that season, the Brigadier one, I thought had quite a lot of atmosphere, and it was playing with time in a way the Doctor Who really didn't bother doing much, which I thought was fairly interesting. There was, I remember as a kid being generally confused, was this the Doctor? So there was some good stuff in there.
No, I wouldn't argue that there wasn't any good stuff.
The Black Guardian was done 20 times better than The Key to Time.
Yeah.
And then Resurrection of the Daleks was, I think, a very strong Dalek story. Yes, it did have a bit of backstory to it, but I don't think... I agree with what you're saying. I think the best way to reintroduce old villains is not to get bogged down in the past. I think Russell T. Davies and Moffat have shown that that's a good approach. At the same time, I think that season gets too much criticism for it. I don't think it's that bad. And as I say, none of the stories apart from really feel like they're retreading the old ground of the adversaries and companions that they're meeting again. I didn't feel that really at all. I think Attack of the Cybermen is possibly the worst example of what you're talking about, where it goes far too far. I totally agree there.
Yeah.
And it's because they didn't even do it well. I mean, I know it's a very new way of doing things, but if they'd brought back the costumes from the old 60s show, at least even those who are into the sort of the canon history of Doctor Who might have a little more easy understanding to whether these are new Cybermen or are they meant to be the old ones. And it's just a mess on every front.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think there are times that Turner did go too far. I just think occasionally I think I'm surprised that season gets stick, because there's some quite clever stories in there.
Okay. My second question concerns the Colin Baker era, really, and specifically the Trial of a Time Lord. And because, as we know, Doctor Who was put on hiatus for 18 months for various reasons that we either believe or disbelieve. Either BBC couldn't afford to make it, or what was the other thing? This whole issue with Colin Baker, just ratings, violence, all that kind of thing. However, it then came back 18 months later with a linked series of four stories. I think I'm right in saying, all linked with courtroom drama, thrilling. And photo caption recaps at the beginning of every episode. Now, without getting too much into the whole Trial of a Time Lord thing, because we could do that at any time in the future.
And we should.
And we definitely should. Was that what? It clearly was a bad idea, so I'm not going to ask, was the Trial of the Time Lord a bad idea? What should have been the response from John Nathan Turner and his fracturing relationship with Eric Saward and the general Doctor Who production team? What should they have done instead of mimicking real life and putting the Doctor on trial? What should they have done?
Well, that's easy. They should have focused on what could make the show what it should be. Not let's try and prove, let's put ourselves on trial, let's put the show on trial. All they had to do was just find their direction again with the show. And I know it sounds so easy when you say all they had to do, but I mean they should have focused on what wasn't working. Why were we on hiatus? You know, what are the elements that just aren't coming together here and make them work? You know, find a way. And, you know, in John's era, he had the makings of good eras. He had the good ways to make things work. And he did well in the past before that season. You know, all he had to do is just go back and revisit those things and, you know, tap into his strengths. But instead, it seemed like it was taken as a personal attack. And let's put the show on as part of that personal attack. It seemed like the show was used as a rebuttal to reality to me. And yeah. I think that's where it was a failure. It should have been focused on as what it was, which is a show for people's entertainment.
James?
Yeah, I think it's one of his bad decisions. It's a funny thing because, I mean, he was so good with his decisions in season 18 when he got... Essentially, you know, he had the guts to actually push his team into getting rid of Tom Baker. Which is quite a, you know, quite a dangerous, risky thing for a show to do. I don't think Tom Baker liked it. I don't think he particularly got on well with John Nathan Turner and those stupid shirts. I mean, no one gets quite as shirty about pineapples as Tom Baker does. But but you know, it was a dangerous thing that he did. It was a dangerous thing he did, and I felt in the Trial of the Time Lord, he had a situation where. He had to do something dangerous. He had to do something to prove the show. He had to actually go out on a limb again. But what he was doing wasn't going out on a limb. It felt too quagmired, as you say. I think you put it perfectly, in having to justify the show, which isn't what he should have had to have done.
It's quite a postmodern statement, though, isn't it?
Well, the Time Lord. Yeah, it is. And this is what I was going to say. My answer to your question would be, if he wanted to do that, and I can understand, fine. What he should have done, in my opinion, rather than falling into... I know LA Law, and that was very popular in the States at the time, possibly where he thought the courtroom drama might have some interest over here because of that sort of niche. But he should have just done them as very good, straight episodes, which, unusual for the time, would have culminated in the final story being on trial. For things that had happened in that story. So the audience could have followed the story with the Doctor. It's a more pedestrian route, but I think it would have seemed a lot less choppy, a lot less invasive, and the focus would have been on, say, three really good stories, and then his choices in those stories coming up in this final adventure, which involves the Valiard, if you want the Valiard, or the Master, preferably not both. I think that was a dumb thing to do. I know, obviously, they had issues at the time, which probably caused that mess, but... that's the way I think I'd have done it if you had to go down that route. The problem was that Doctor Who, was Doctor Who a silly concept to have on television? It wasn't on trial itself. What I think was on trial was whether it still could tap into an audience. And the mistake was not actually trying to prove that Doctor Who was quality enough to tap into an audience and not have to pretend it's something else. Or, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you think, Brian?
Yes. I concur. I've already given mine. It's your turn.
Oh, is it me?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yes.
Well, to be honest with you, it's so tempting, isn't it? And you can see why he did it. He was probably extremely affronted by what was going on in terms of how he was being perceived to be looking after the show. So you can see why he would have done it. And I can't say that I wouldn't. But what he should have done is exactly as you said. He should have just buckled down and got on with it. He could have just brought in a new companion, which wouldn't have been. And I'm not saying he shouldn't have, you know, done it, carried on with the continuity, or just brought in a brand new companion at the beginning and left Perry hanging somewhere, you know, or we could have just introduced a new companion for the rest of the series. It should have gone back to basics. With the whole nature of the Doctor wandering through time and space, stayed away from the Time Lords, IKEA,
definitely,
credit card, store card.
Do you think he should have gone back to the Three Companion and actually, you know, because Moffat did that. By the looks of it, anyway, we don't know for sure, but it always seemed evident to me that bringing Rory in was to help the show, the dynamic within the TARDIS, more than the fact that they just wanted to bring Rory in. They felt it would benefit the dynamic. So perhaps someone else would have helped.
Well, I think they'd had too much of that, hadn't they, in recent years. I think they'd had too many double companions. Well, they could have brought in a male companion instead of a girl.
Yeah, well, I just felt that maybe that was what was lacking a little. It just needed someone else to play off.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think a changing companion was needed. And clearly so did John Nathan Turner. He got it completely wrong with Bonnie Langford.
How did he think that was a good move? I remember at the time being stunned by it, and I was a child. What are you doing?
The Trial of a Time Lord has some good ideas in it, some very interesting ideas in it, I would say. And sadly, we've got this problem with the previous series that was penciled in, that got quite a way in pre-production. So I wouldn't like to go ahead with Trial of a Time Lord without seeing these shows produced if I was in this position. You know, I think it's a shame that they abandoned them all completely. And I know it's probably not easy to get Michael Gough, but there was other shows in there that, you know, there was other episode stories in there they could have done. But at the same time, there are some good ideas in Trial of a Time Lord, which I think, you know, the whole Ravelox thing is fascinating. So,
as you know, Mind stories, Warps, I mean,
Mind
think...
Warp's a marvellous story as well. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't end well. He's got some wobbly bits in it. The rest of them have. But, like, the ideas, you know, there's nothing about the Trial of a Time Lord, the actual adventures in there, apart until you get to Vervoids, that are bad. It's just that they're not incredibly well executed. They could probably do with some more editing before they get to the shooting stage. Sorry, Brian.
No, that's fine. I was going to say, as individual stories, I thought that they worked better on their own. I think what it was that we kept having the stories interrupted to have people talk about the stories that we were watching, you know, and it's just that's not enjoyable. I mean, you could easily argue, of course, which is the case, that the trial itself was like an extra story within that season. But I think they could have made the trial a story within itself rather than bookended.
It works if you sat watching it on DVD, doesn't it? If you're gonna have a Trial of a Time Lord marathon, then it works. But no one was having a Trial of a Time Lord marathon in 1986, were they?
No.
So you've got this whole response to "We're on trial" by putting the Doctor on trial, being all sort of postmodern about it, and then people start getting distracted and people are getting bored by photo caption recaps at the beginning of each episode because you've gone completely balmy in your production. I mean, did he wear those crazy shirts before Trial of a Time Lord? Because I'm thinking maybe there was some sort of breakdown for John Nathan Turner in the middle of Trial of a Time Lord, which resulted in the wearing of these crazy shirts.
Well, there's obviously a lot of trouble within the... I mean, I was to say we need to go back on this on different podcasts, but... Trial of the Time Lord was made weaker by its internal strifes. We're not just talking the end with Soward and Turner, but we're also talking sort of midway with the choices on Perry's departure and everything. And
Bob Holmes dying as well.
Oh yeah, Bob Holmes, yes, died, absolutely, yeah. Yes, yeah. Totally. So there's a lot of things going on that we can do. But as I say, I think that's something we should... is it worth touching the McCoy? Because we've not really talked about the McCoy era.
I'd rather not touch him, but we can certainly talk about him.
Well, if you so wish. I have him right here, but fine. You want to talk about him while he's here and he can sit here by himself? That's fine. He doesn't mind.
Okay.
He has a couple of ferrets to keep himself happy.
I thought he might have some spoons. Well, you know, we were going to get to that anyway, weren't we? It's in some ways, it's kind of John Nathan Turner in microcosm, the whole Sylvester McCoy era. You think?
That's
only
very...
in reverse.
That's a very journalistic approach to this. I like it. Well, it is. It's very interesting, and it's a good point. Go on with it, please.
Because it starts off all fluffy. And, you know, there's big fluffy bits in the John Nathan Turner. There's big fluffy bits on John Nathan Turner's face. But there's big fluffy bits in the John Nathan Turner era of Doctor Who. And then as things go, it gets quickly... I say quickly, from the second series and into the third series, things quickly develop into this tighter, darker, new direction for the Doctor, just as John Nathan Turner and Chris Bidmead introduced in 1980. It's not the same direction, it's a new direction, and it's fascinating. And watching it now, it doesn't look as dated. I mean, watching the 1988 series is kind of somewhere in between. Depends what you're watching. Watching the 1989 series, there's very little to set it apart from what Russell T. Davies was doing in 2005, other than, you know, budget and special effects. There's a world of difference between the three series, but if you you take the 1989 series, it doesn't look dated. You look at the 1987 series, it looks horrible, horribly dated. So that's what I meant by microcosm. That whole, it's like every single approach is in there. It's like every single tone of the John Nathan Turner era of Doctor Who is in those three series.
Yeah, I think that's interesting.
Including the bleeding question marks.
You know, and with those stupid question marks, the only one I never minded was the umbrella. Every other one, the colors,
I don't mind the umbrella, the jumper. I don't mind the identity card either.
Oh, yeah, no, I'll give you that.
Yeah, I'm fine with both, smart. Yeah.
But no, the you know, the question marks on the sweater and the shirt collar. Oh dear.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think as you say, I think by the sort of second two seasons, it sort of found its tone. Not quite, because there were still bits. I mean, I remember at the time, and I was about 11, 12. I remember saying to my friend that I felt that Survival, which of course, as we know, was the last one they transmitted, felt to me as if it didn't know whether it was aimed at a Blue Peter audience or an adult audience, where the rest of the show seemed to be going, not adult, but sort of teens.
You were very eloquent at 12, weren't you?
I actually was quite eloquent, I'm afraid. It wasn't much different. I was very, very similar. But I did feel that. I did feel that there was a... It didn't quite know what it was doing, and that frustrated me. I mean, the idea of the cats in Survival was quite a nice idea, but they looked a little, it looked like a little childish. Helen Pace in there, some of the dialogue, and of course the fuzzy panto cheetah people. It's as if it didn't know quite where it was going. And then you've got the some of the original ideas for Curse of Fenric would have had the creatures looking a lot more menacing. And it just felt, I think in part it was Nathan Turner still not quite sure where to direct the show in terms of vision at that point, which went against where Cartmell was taking it, which was actually quite a dark and, as I say, intelligent 15 to 16 year old, I'd have said.
Yeah.
If you take things like Curse of Fenric and Ghostlight and Remembrance of the Daleks. But the production just didn't seem to be able to fit that value, and I don't know, maybe that's it, just maybe it might have just been budget, but I don't think it was just budget. I think occasionally it just didn't know quite how to be.
I think the effect of, you know, people like Mae Whitehouse and what happened with Colin Baker.
Yes, definitely.
Although I think his fingers were burned by that, weren't they?
Yeah, so it felt, yeah, I think that's totally it. It felt safe. Curse of Fenric, which was a brilliant plot, fantastic plot, very well executed, sort of delivered with a direction which was very solid and quite somber and mature, taking the and again Doctor Who was starting to really look at social issues of racism and social and ideologies and
eugenics as well with the side
yes, well, in that deeply serious episode. And but it was doing something, but it just didn't quite feel as if it knew quite how to really do that. As we could say, it felt like the ideas were ahead of its time, and I think they were.
Yeah,
I think you had a new wave of story writers coming out at the late 80s. We're not just talking about Cartmell, we're obviously talking we're talking about various people, Mark, you know, Ben Rinovich, Mark Platt,
yeah, yeah.
And then slightly after that, obviously, we've got in the books, which were, you know, a platform for a lot of new writing for Doctor Who, new ideas from fans, you know, obviously Paul Cornell, you know, Kate Orman. You've got a lot of intelligent writers coming out there with this, and it was just a little too early in a way. The production value, and I think the way that John Nathan Turner knew how to produce a show, wasn't what it needed to be. It needs to get out of the Saturday night, you know, silly opportunity knocks feel to it, even though it wasn't on Saturday anymore, and it just didn't know where I'd to be quite fair to it, I don't know where it could have gone, to be honest. I can't think of a show on television around that time which would have you know, a niche it could have fallen into without having to create its own niche. I mean, could it just got moved? Could it have gone darker? Would that have been the way to do it? And
I think a kind of TARDIS-less situation would probably have been on the cards at some point.
That would have worked.
A kind of a retread of the John Pertwee era, but you know, without UNIT, etc. Maybe, you know, leaving the Doctor as some sort of get going in X-Files direction, and in some regards, it was going in that direction anyway.
Mm. Well, I always felt that when I saw the X-Files, I kept thinking, you know, if Doctor Who came back, it could just do this. And to be fair, things like Probe were doing it in the independent video market, and that would have been a good direction. But I, you know, without that foresight, the nearest thing I could have seen Doctor Who really having to try and travel to become would be something like Sapphire and Steel. But that was a very dark and very cold series, as Bidmead was, to be fair. It would have gone back to something like Bidmead. Do you think Bidmead's stuff would have been good at the end of the 80s, or do you think just Doctor Who had its time for the period?
I don't think it had its time. I just think there was a, you know, people were still watching it, so it can't have had its time. If it had its time, no one would have been watching it at all. If the BBC really didn't want people to watch it, like really, really didn't want people to watch it, they'd have shoved it on BBC Two at 10 o'clock on a Sunday or a Monday or 11 o'clock, you know. And Doctor Who clearly hadn't had its time, because just a couple of years later, they were running reruns and more people were watching Doctor Who than were watching, you know, on a Sunday morning. And more people were watching Doctor Who on a Sunday morning than were watching, you know, everything else that was on that Sunday morning. Doctor Who was drawing in audiences, and you know, classic Doctor Who. So it definitely hadn't had its time. And to say that it had, and I'm not saying that you're wrong, saying the people that are saying that it had its time were absolutely wrong. It just needed another regeneration, not necessarily a regeneration of the Doctor. It just needed another reformatting, as it had many years before.
But it showed a... Sorry, Brian.
No, I was going to say, when something has its time, generally it's because there's nothing left to tell with it. You know, you've reached the end. You can't go any further. The people who are behind it can't think of anything else. When Doctor Who went off air, I don't think a TV show or franchise has ever thrived to tell more stories after its decline or after its end on TV than Doctor Who. You know, I mean, it had such life in comic strips and books and radio dramas, even fan films or independent productions. You know, that clearly there was, this TV show had not had its time. There was so much of it. And then just the fact that it came back with such strength as it did shows that, you know, they should have just had a little bit more faith, because there could have been a gradual change to becoming the show that it became today, rather than just dumping it and picking it up later on with those changes. I think watching Sylvester McCoy's last season showed me that clearly if they had just kept the show going, we would have gotten to where we are naturally.
It's funny, but do you feel in the 90s at the BBC, they seem to me as if the BBC seemed bemused by it, as if they could see the figures. They could see, as you said, Christian, that, you know, on the BSB that it was doing well. They could see, you know, that the books were selling. You know, it was a very strong Virgin range that was going out, not short, not long after it was cancelled. There was a great love of this show, which was very popular. And yet I do genuinely feel that people at the BBC had thought it had its time.
Well, I think if you're going to challenge accountants in that way, then they're going to think that something's had its time. Yeah,
it's just but they, even then, they seemed almost guilty in the 90s, as if they sort of kind of knew that maybe somehow they should be doing something with it, but
I think they knew,
didn't
they,
understand,
you know,
it.
There was a lot of stuff going on in the background, wasn't there, and they knew that they couldn't afford to make it in the way that maybe they thought it should be made. But at the same time, there was this whole, you know, there was this culture of, thanks to a previous Conservative government, there was this culture of penny pinching going on at the BBC, extreme budgeting and reorganisation, and I think that probably had a strong effect as well. But as I say, we knew that there was something going on in the background, even though they maybe didn't, the people in the show. John Nathan Turner might have had an inkling, and he probably knew quite soon that he wasn't going to be involved with the TV movie, or the, you know, like the what would eventually become the TV movie, but you know, the sale of the movie rights and the BBC kind of demurring in favour of that, which was, as we know, an awful mistake. But then again, let's not take this personally as Doctor Who fans. as many people have done over the years, because you only need to have a look at the recent interviews with Craig Charles and Chris Barry and Robert Llewellyn and Danny John-Jules over Red Dwarf X to find out that Doctor isn't the only show that's been put into development hell whilst they wait for a movie to be made. That one of the main reasons why there's been no Red Dwarf over the past 12 years is because they've been waiting for the movie to be made, and it just hasn't come about. And I think maybe as Doctor Who fans, we tend to get a bit over the top about this. And yes, there was a culture at the BBC there were people at the BBC in high positions who didn't understand Doctor Who, as you say, James, and didn't know what the hell was going on. But I think we sometimes get a bit carried away that the BBC had some sort of big agenda to kill Doctor Who, and I don't think that that's true. I think they had an agenda to make more money from Doctor Who with perhaps less production time, or without outside help, and that's how this whole movie thing came along. And as Red Dwarf have proven, it's happened again.
I think to a degree. I mean, I think I totally agree with you. I don't think there was a master plan to kill Doctor Who, but I think the BBC at the time, before they even considered the sort of movie options, there was a very cold, dispassionate look at the show as a show, rather than as what it actually carried to other people. So when it couldn't compete against Coronation Street, which to say was the biggest, biggest highest viewing show in the country, it was never looked in any context apart from the fact that it's been going on for so many years. We need a change, and there was obviously pressures to try and, as I've said many times before, the soap industry was expanding massively at that time.
Yeah.
And they wanted to put all their money into soaps, and so El Dorado took it. It was killed by Coronation Street and replaced by El Dorado. I agree with you. I don't think it was a conspiracy about Doctor Who. I think a lot of Doctor Who fans overrate their importance in the scheme of things. I think it was a bad choice that they thought they could re-sort out later on.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was a fad for soaps, which is why I say I'm never quite sure how much of it is John Nathan Turner's fault or Sylvester McCoy's fault or the production's fault. Just simply there was a time of change in the BBC and they were just had no interest in really looking to see what Doctor Who was doing. They were just looking at the latest gravy train.
Yeah, yeah. I'd agree with that, definitely.
It's a shame, but it's a shame for Sylvester, cause, you know, that recent Milton Keynes thing where he makes an offhand comment that he killed Doctor Who, and there must be a part of him which sometimes wonders if he did, and I always feel for him for that. You shouldn't carry that legacy, nor should Nathan Turner, because John Nathan Turner carried it going for a strong 8-10 years.
Yeah, well, 8 or 9 years. Yeah,
apart from a couple of axes and stuff like that. But yeah. Did anyone want to mention any of their favourites before? Because I feel we're going to close in a sec.
Yeah, we probably will. I was thinking of maybe mentioning a great thing in your opinion, a bad thing in your opinion, and a favourite episode from that era. So, Brian?
Oh, sure. Start with me.
Yeah.
Bless.
No. Oh, that's fine. A great thing in their period. Let's see. I did like the shift. I would say a great thing would be the shift at the end of Tom Baker's era, and of course the shift at the end of Sylvester McCoy's era. I thought they were good directional shifts, regardless of the fact that Tom Baker, unfortunately, just didn't have his heart in it, as we could tell, or wasn't allowed to even have his heart in it. Bad things in his era were character treatments throughout Peter Davison and Colin Baker's era, in my opinion, as well as rather unfortunate costume decisions. And if I had to go, this is really tough, because if I had to go for a favorite story, even just picking one, I think I'm going to go all the way up to Sylvester McCoy's era and kind of just stick with Curse of Fenric. I think it was the first time in a long time we had had a rather interesting new foe for the Doctor with very intricate plot, and I liked the way that the companion wasn't just someone who was there, she was very much a part of the plot. So I would say that would have to be the one I would call out.
James?
I think I have to mirror a lot of Brian's comments, I'm afraid. I think for me, Legopolis was a testament to Chris Bidmead. Well, to be fair, a testament to Chris Bidmead as much as John Nathan Turner. But, you know, John Nathan Turner had allowed them to go down that route, which I don't think many other, certainly none of the producers beforehand, I think, would have gone down. No. So I think you've got to give him credit for putting his own stamp rather than trying to just follow what had been previously popular.
Yeah.
I admire that in him. I do feel his mistakes, as I've said before, were in the fact he considered it too much of a variety performance show, and that reflects itself in the costumes and some of the castings, which I think was his bad trait. Favorite story, I think I'm going to go for a McCoy one as well, since I've just mentioned Legopolis. I think I might have to go for I think I love Remembrance of the Daleks. I think it's okay. Just passionately got everything about classic Doctor Who in there. It feels like it could be a Troughton story in some ways, and yeah. Yet it feels intelligent, like a new 80s.
And it's topical as well.
Who. Yes.
It's topical with a new countermeasure series.
Oh, very much so, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Nicely deployed. And yourself?
I think I would go for best thing that he did, I think, was killing the sonic screwdriver.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, I do, yeah. And I'm maybe just a little bit sick of the sonic screwdriver now. Not as much as the slightly upset Sarah Jane Smith might have been at the end of Hand of Fear. But and it wasn't the same kind of portable computer, scanner, door unlocker.
BlackBerry. iPhone.
iPhone, yeah. Do everything in one tool that it is now. I feel that those challenges that they talk about, you know, it gets the Doctor out of a locked room, etc. Well, why don't we want the Doctor to be in a locked room? You know, there's so many interesting things that could be done without the sonic screwdriver, and I'd like to see the end of the sonic screwdriver now, which is why I would say that was a brilliant thing to do then. I think it gave the Doctor back this opportunity to live on his wits a bit more and to talk his way out of problems. And just, you know, it doesn't have to be boring to talk your way out of problems. I'm going to leave it there. The worst thing was two things. One of them was called Pip, the other one was called Jane, and they were both called Baker. I'm saying no more about it. But best episode by far and away has to be Case of Androzani.
Oh, that would have been my third choice. I'm really pleased with our choices there. I think they were very nice ones. Yes.
Okay. Right, well, that brings us to the end of the Series Cast Service podcast with a K. That's a kick and cut. And we'll be back next week to talk about more Doctor Who stuff. Until then, it's goodbye from us.
Previously on next week's podcast.
I'm sorry, I seem to have mislaid my laser spanner.